Radio.
This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Feline friends, welcome to Catitude. We have a very interesting show today. We're going to talk to the new director of Paws, and we'll talk about how animals are affected, our cats are affected with animal welfare, and different legal implications, something that we don't usually talk about, but it's there, and it's important for you to know about. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
You know the expression, cats have nine lives. Well, what if you can give them one more? The Give Them 10 movement is on a mission to help give cats an extra life. How? With spay and neuter. Spaying or neutering your cat helps them live a longer, healthier life. And it helps control free-roaming cat populations too. Learn more about the benefits of spay and neuter and meet Scooter, the neutered cat, at givethem10.org. That's givethem10.org.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back, everyone. I'd like to welcome Sherry Hines. She is a professor at the University of Georgia Law with a focus on animal welfare. Welcome, Sherry.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you. Can you share a little bit about your background for our listeners?
Sure, absolutely. I have to be honest, I never thought in a million years when I went to law school that I would be able to specialize in animal law. I'd always said that I volunteered with animals and I worked with people, but here I am now as a professor at UGA, and one of my main focuses, as you said, is animal law. In fact, I'll be teaching a class next year called Crimes Against Animals that I'm developing. In terms of my background, I graduated from law school and worked as a public defender. So the typical, if someone can't afford representation, someone will be appointed. That was me for about 6.5 years. So I've had a good exposure to the criminal defense side of things. Following that, I worked for the Institute of Continuing Legal Education. So I cut a little of the education focus. And then the vast majority of my time, so about 7.5 years, immediately prior to coming to UGA, I was able to work in the Athens Hart County Attorney's Office, which was a fantastic opportunity to start leveraging kind of my interest in animal law, because I was able to serve as the attorney advising our animal services department. I was able to prosecute all of the animal ordinance violations that occurred in Athens Hart County, to assist in animal cruelty prosecutions, and to help with dangerous dogs and legislation drafting. So specifically, I was able to help with TNR program for cats. So it's been a really fun ability to sort of shift my focus to something I'm so passionate about. In terms of more of a personal history, I have always been around animals because my dad was a vet growing up, and we were primarily a cat household, although we had lots of other animals. I have volunteered with wildlife. I did that for a while because, as I'm sure many of your listeners can understand, sometimes it can be challenging going to shelters and knowing that you can't save them all. So working with wildlife was a little bit of a break from that. But since then, so since about 2016 on, I've focused pretty much all of my volunteer activity with companion animals. So I've served on the board of multiple nonprofits, animal-related nonprofits. I'm currently on the board of the Madison Oglethorpe Animal Shelter, which is a small rural shelter, and we're very much a working board. I was the president for 5 years. I've also served as a foster parent and a volunteer for lots of different local animal rescue groups, originally focusing a lot on cats. That was how I got involved, as a cat volunteer. But my husband has gradually turned me into just as much of a dog person as a cat person. So I've really, I'm one of those people that, like, I would hug an alligator if someone gave me one, and I was fairly confident it wasn't going to bite me.
So let me ask you about this. Thank you for sharing your background.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming on the show today. I have a question, because my background is in business. So the only law class I took was business law. So very different. But that is not too common, unless I missed something researching. It seemed to be not very common, you know, animal law, animal welfare. Is that something new?
That's right. It is something that's newer. There's certainly some places where it's been established for a long time, like Vermont has a really good law school that's been focusing on this for a long time. And there's certainly others across the nation. But you're right that animal law as a specialty is not something typically that people will go in and only practice animal law. And there are good reasons why animal law as a specialty is just now sort of coming forward. And I think one of the main ones is that animal law tends to touch on lots of different practice areas that are not necessarily combined except as it relates to animals. So animals are considered property, even though we all love them and we think of them as our children sometimes. Animals are legally the same as a car, except that you have to feed it. You have to take care of it in a different way. So there are property interests related to divorce and wills and estates and things like that that are kind of one niche area. But then you certainly have like an agriculture side of the animal law field, where people are worried about, you know, farming and humane practices. Then you have issues related to criminal law, which of course is my focus. We're talking about enforcement and animal protection. So there's just a lot of different facets. And a lot of times the attorney who practices one isn't going to practice another. And so that's why you won't come across many people who practice solely in this area, but you will come across a lot of attorneys who have to deal with this in some form or fashion. You know, from time to time in their career.
Yeah, I could see the rarity and why it's such a specialization. We have a few topics I would want to talk about. Let's talk about pet safety and legal considerations during holiday adoption surges. This is something that is like a thorn in my side, drives me crazy. So during the holidays, shelters always see a spike in adoptions. So from a legal and welfare viewpoint, what risks do you see with that trend?
Yeah, it's a challenge, right? Because shelters want animals to move out because at least they have a good chance, one hopes, of a successful outcome outside of the shelter, particularly when we're talking about open admission shelters that are constantly at capacity and really struggling to manage that population. On the other hand, we certainly know that there are a lot of people who impulse adopt animals during holidays at the end of the year, around Christmas, and that a lot of those animals may come back to us, you know, in the next month to a year when people realize that maybe they haven't thought through that decision.
That's what bothers me. The fact that they'll adopt, you know, it's puppy and a kitten. They grow up to be dogs and cats. And people don't think it through about the dedication, the expense, the fact that, you know, cats scratch things, you know, people, they just think, you know, oh, my little daughter, or my little son wants a little cat, or I'm bored, I want a cat, little cat. And they don't think it through. And I just think it's traumatic for the cat to have to go, or the dog. They think they're going to forever home, then they'll go back. And sometimes this happens multiple times, but it seems to definitely peak around the holidays.
You're absolutely right. And I think the best thing that shelters can do is to try to educate owners adopters and make sure that to the best of the shelter's ability, these people appear to have really thought through. It's one of the challenges with adoptions at like pet stores around the holidays. And I think some shelters actually decide not to do those because it's so easy for someone to impulse adopt at a store, as opposed to actually thinking, yes, I want an animal and making a considered choice. I'm actually going to the shelter to do that. This is one more step to try to reduce that impulse. You know, theoretically, shelters have adoption contracts, but I think there are a lot of challenges to trying to enforce those. And at the end of the day, we don't want to try to force families to keep animals they don't want that they're not going to care for. So it's not really a good legal avenue to try to stop people from returning. It's more about education on the front end.
Right. Education on the front end and have them think it through. I know some shelters have you complete a form and then you cannot adopt out that same day. You have to come back.
Yes, that's a fantastic method to try to make sure that people are serious. It's one that some shelters don't use when they are usually at such high capacity and they desperately need the space. But to your point, if you're making space today, but you know that there's a good chance your adoptions are going to fail and they're going to come back to you in a couple months, that's not really a good solution at the end of the day.
No, definitely not. I told you what infuriates me. What infuriates you about when people are gifting puppies and kittens during the holidays?
I think the thing that's most troublesome to me is the surprise gifts of animals. No one should ever receive a puppy, a kitten, or even like an adult animal as a surprise gift. I mean, I understand if it's a small child, that's a different thing. But we have a lot of people who come to our shelter saying, I want to adopt a cat for my mom. Your mom needs to come and pick that animal out. I think people forget that when we're talking about cats, it's, you know, hopefully a 15 to 20 plus year commitment. Dogs, it's hopefully at least a 10 year commitment. And so those are not things that should be sprung upon someone as a surprise. Those animal to human bonds are really important and really individual. And people need to respect that, yes, animals are legally property, but they are very different than going and buying your mom a tea leaf for Christmas. And they need to be treated differently, more carefully.
Yes, absolutely. And I also know that some shelters are even kind of adverse to adopting out the, you know, cats to older people, unless they know that there is somebody to take care of the cats. You know, somebody that wants to adopt a cat that's 80, 90, what's going to happen if, God forbid, something happens to the person? So they want people to really think it through. So something happens to you, is there someone else in the family that's going to take care of this? Your cat.
I think that's a really important point, too. It occurred to me to say one thing, because on the earlier topic, the shelter that I work for example, we will not adopt out if someone says it's a gift. So that's one way I think shelters can combat that. But to your point about, you know, adopting to people who are older, I think that's a really challenging conversation to have, because on one hand, I think we want to really be clear that shelters are not discriminating against people based on their age. I mean, realistically, any of us could be hit by a bus tomorrow, right? Or we might have underlying health problems. At the same time, you are absolutely right to recognize as a practical reality that when people are adopting, you know, a very young animal that hopefully will live for a decade or two, that planning for the care of the animal is really important. And I think this is pretty common, or it should be common, with other types of animals. For instance, like certain turtles, parrots, like they frequently outlive their owners because they have a long lifespan. But I think you're right that we need to have greater conversations about what is your plan for this animal so that it does have a safety net if something does happen to an owner.
Right. So it's just planning. It just makes sense. Just planning.
That's right.
Okay. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back.
Real people, real stories.
Our little dog developed this lymph problem, but the chemotherapy lasted for 6 months, started developing more lymph nodes. So I thought I'd just try carnivore. The lymph nodes started to go down. Then I took him into the vet to have him checked out, and there was no signs at all inside.
My cat had issues that developed in his eye, and 3 months later, my veterinarian said, let's go ahead and remove the eye. I heard the carnivore advertising. So I said, you know what? I'm going to order this product. They did the procedure. They did all the tests, and they said, I don't know what you did. This product saved his eye.
I've got a Labrador. He could hardly lift herself up off the floor. The treatment was chemotherapy. That's when I said, this could be the ticket. About 3 weeks, you could tell she was very alert. She was going on 5 mile walk. She is just like prime again.
Call 866-836-8735. That's 866-836-8735. Or visit carnivore.com. That's CARNIVORA.com.
Use promo code PETLIFE at checkout for 15% off your order at carnivora.com.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back, everyone. We're talking to Sherry Hines, professor of law specializing in animal welfare. Okay, here's another topic I wanted to talk to you about. What are the dangers of no-kill shelter branding and their legal implications? So, for example, no-kill is really powerful in the shelter world, but can shelters really claim to be no-kill? Or are there exceptions other than, you know, a cat passing away, unfortunately, is not killed. It could be that there's some cats that are sick and that are going to pass away. That's not the same as killed. But what about those shelters that are no kill? Do they have certain legal implications? Do they have that they have to follow so that you know if you're going there to adopt, no cats are euthanized? It's just that's, you know, how they work.
Yeah, I think this is probably one of the most important, if not the most important, conversations that's happening in the animal rescue world right now. So I really appreciate you asking me about it. I think the first thing to say to kind of the question you just asked is there's no legal designation of no kill, certainly no official legal designation. But what we all have kind of established in the community that it means is that a rescue group or a shelter doesn't euthanize more than 10% of its population at any given year. And it makes sense for those of you who are listening who are upset to hear that they do have this 10% wiggle room. It makes sense because there are times when rescue groups, despite their best efforts, do need to euthanize an animal. For instance, an animal that is, you know, horribly ill, you know, has cancer, even though it's an end of the life euthanasia, if they're properly recording the outcomes for their animals, it is still considered a euthanasia. Additionally, sometimes rescue groups take on animals with really severe behavioral issues. And despite everyone's best efforts at training or medication, whatever, this animal, you know, maybe has bitten too many folks. We even had a cat, believe it or not, that was too aggressive and that would attack people.
Especially if a cat's declawed.
Right. So it's just one of those situations where there does need to be some wiggle room for organizations when they have animals that they just can't safely continue to house or adopt out. But I think the bigger problem is that we really shouldn't be using the words kill or no kill to describe shelters or rescue groups. And I agree with you. It's a very powerful term. And the reason they do use it is because factually it's true, right? They euthanize less than 10%, but also because they know the public will support no kill shelters or rescue groups before they will support kill shelters or groups because of a perception that, you know, the shelters, you know, the animals are going to die at the shelter or other concerns people have.
Okay. I want to clarify one thing. I don't agree that aggressive cats should be killed. I know that some cats will be excessively aggressive once they are declawed, especially biting, which is what most people think of when they say my cat's aggressive. It's cats biting. And that's when cats are declawed because they have no other way of defending themselves. So, and then when you mentioned the 10%, it seems like, I guess in generalizing, the no-kill 10% are cats and dogs that are, there's a small chance of them making it once they're adopted. They're sick or they're extremely aggressive. I even had a situation in my, a family member adopted a dog, but it wasn't, I don't recall if they went to it. They went to a shelter. This was years ago, and the dog was from, and I know we're Catitude, but this is a dog story. You guys can relate. So this dog was adopted from the streets of, I think, Puerto Rico during a hurricane. The dog had never been in a home. The dog literally bit through, I don't even know how he did it, a metal cage, chewed up wooden blinds. And then it wasn't the fact that things were destroyed. It was the fact that this poor dog is going to be injured because there wasn't somebody home, you know, 24/7, but there was somebody home enough. And the dog would need intense, intense training. Now, the shelter I found in this situation, because I grilled my family member, the shelter was at fault because they didn't disclose this. They wanted to adopt the dog out. But my family member would have said, this is not the dog for us because we don't have the time to put in to really train. I mean, this dog needed intense training, was never in a home. Actually, the dog went nuts, broke through a metal, you know, they were crate training, the dog crate trained, chewed up wooden blinds. Then they broke through again and chewed something else, and they feared for the dog's safety. So they brought the dog back. I mean, that's an extreme situation, and I normally would go nuts on a situation like this if, you know, to my family, I'm going to say, well, we adopted, but we returned. But in this case, the shelter should have disclosed this.
That's right. And I think that's the pressure, right? No-kill shelters want to adopt out animals. And everybody, of course, gets into this because you want to save animals. But the reality is that there are some animals that just really cannot safely be maintained in a house. And so I think what I really want to emphasize to your listeners is that instead of saying kill or no kill, what is more helpful is to think about open intake facilities versus closed intake facilities. So to be clear, I think there's value on both sides. Like, we need all of these organizations.
Can you clarify the difference?
Yeah. So a closed intake facility or rescue group is a group that chooses what animals come into their care. So they can select them. They can deliberately, if they so choose, pick animals that are younger, friendlier, healthier, of desirable breeds, more adoptable than open intake facilities, which are ones that commonly have a contract with a local government, or they are in fact a government-run shelter, and they exist to take in every single animal, at least of a certain species, right, that needs to come into a shelter. And a lot of people disparage the open intake shelters because of necessity, they do have to perform euthanasia. Whether that's because a dog got hit on the road and desperately needs to be euthanized for humane reasons, or whether that's because they are overflowing with animals and they don't have the space and you can't humanely warehouse animals indefinitely. But those open intake shelters are incredibly important. I think what the data shows is that if animals don't have a place to come in, then that's where we have lots of roaming feral animals. Here where I live, we had a dog pack, just a roaming group of dogs that nobody cared for, that attacked an older couple and mauled them to death.
Oh, my God.
So there are very real harms to having large numbers of animals roaming because their owners didn't have a place to take them, or concerned citizens didn't have a place to take them, even if it's just concerns about rabies and the spread of disease, right? And so open intake facilities give people the ability to bring that stray dog or that stray cat, or even I'm a terrible person, right? And I took these animals in and I just don't want them anymore because they have fleas or whatever. You know, I'm not trying to pass judgment, but just, you know, you've decided you don't like animals, you don't want these anymore, and you want someone else to take responsibility for them. Shelters exist because at the end of the day, it is better for someone to have a place to bring these animals where they can get humane care than to have them abandoned or mistreated or, God forbid, you know, actually abused or starved, et cetera, in homes where they're not wanted.
I absolutely agree, because I think cats are more likely to be, I don't know. I don't know whether cats are more likely to be abandoned or dogs, but I mean, one of my cats was abandoned. And that's how I got Dennis, my first cat. I think people are more likely to think that, you know, the cat can survive out, you know, outside.
Totally.
There's so many outdoor cats and little feral cat communities.
You're absolutely right. I think it's just more socially acceptable, at least in the South in Georgia where I live, for cats to be allowed to roam at large and for dogs to be contained. Although I will say I technically live in a pretty rural county where there are a lot of people who own, you know, 10 acres, or they have farms, and they do allow dogs to roam. The downside of that is that roaming dogs lead to car wrecks. They lead to small pet animals being killed because those dogs naturally have a prey drive, right? You know, and of course, we see these larger risks of feral dogs packing up, but there's all sorts of negative outcomes that can happen by animals running at large. And so the real issue is not the open intake shelter or what people brand as the kill shelter. They are not the bad people, right? They did not get into this work because they want to euthanize animals. The real problem is that we have a serious pet overpopulation problem in the United States, especially in the South, and we don't have laws that require spay neuter. And so people are allowed to irresponsibly breed their animals and then basically dump them either, like, literally outside, dump them to be someone else's problem or to pass away, or they take them to the animal shelter, which is a better choice, of course, but it's still a huge negative impact on the taxpayers. A county that Lisa Milet, who's now the state director of animal welfare in Vermont, you know, she and I have been working with DeKalb County here in Georgia, and they estimated they spent $11 million last year on caring for just unwanted animals in their shelter system. And that doesn't count capital expenses. So I think people don't realize what a huge economic burden it is on governments trying to manage these problems.
It is. And there's a lot of resources for spaying and neutered. So it should just be done. Okay, we have another topic. So let's talk about First Amendment issues in public comments and online spaces. So how does the First Amendment apply with regards to shelters?
Sure. So as a general principle, the First Amendment protects people's right to speak freely about almost any topic that they want to speak about. And where it happens, let me back that up. As a general principle, the First Amendment protects an individual's rights to speak about just about any topic they want to speak about from interference by the government as a general rule or some employers, right? So the reason that it interacts with shelters is that shelters are commonly, and by this I'm referring to those open intake shelters, are commonly government-run facilities. So if you have a shelter that is a government entity, then they have to follow all the same rules and protections for individuals related to the First Amendment. And where that most commonly comes into play is, imagine you have a shelter that is struggling, doesn't have enough resources, they have too many animals, volunteers are upset with how things are being managed, understandably, and volunteers begin posting on that shelter's social media page or on the government's social media page, demanding action, you know, talking about the bad things that they allege are happening at the shelter. You might imagine that a government employee's first instinct might be to hide those or delete those posts because they're negative. Unfortunately, the First Amendment, as a general rule, doesn't allow them to do that. Or maybe I should say fortunately, right? We want people to be able to speak when the government creates what we would call a limited public forum where they can do that. And social media accounts are such a forum. So for those who are living in communities where maybe there is some tension and you're trying to speak up about issues that you see and trying to affect change, I think one thing to remember is that the First Amendment does protect that kind of speech. Now, I will say it gets a little bit more complicated if you are in a government employee who wants to speak up about concerns, as that's outside of my scope today.
I think these days you have to be careful whatever you say, because there's, mm-hmm. I mean, more than ever, my personal opinion, and I'm not going to get political, but there seems to be more frivolous lawsuits than ever and settling that have nothing to do with what is right or wrong. It's just, it'll be cheaper to just settle. So let's just settle. Just a lot of frivolous lawsuits. So do you think the shelters should just restrict people from social, you know, media comments? Because there's a lot that gets twisted out there with social media also.
Yeah, the general advice, and I can't give any legal advice, but the general rule is that if you are an organization, particularly a government organization, that's going to create a social media page, which are fundamentally designed to allow interaction with the community, you do need to allow them to post just about anything that they choose to post. There are some limits, like they can't post pornography, you know, but you'd be surprised. Even hate speech is actually protected by the First Amendment. So the best advice that I've ever heard is, either if you're that uncomfortable with the public possibly making comments, then don't have the social media page at all, or at least disable the feed. But then that sort of defeats the purpose of having the social media account to begin with, right? So I think the better approach is to sort of try to counter things with information, right? If someone posts something that's negative, you can respond and say, thank you so much for this, bringing this concern to our attention. Can we have a private conversation with you? Or we'll send you a private message to discuss this further. Because that way, at least you're showing that you're responsive, that you are paying attention to the community. And maybe you don't have the best answers right now, or maybe you are working through some challenging things, but you're trying to be accountable to your community and you're trying to make improvements. I think what we have seen here in Athens is that your volunteer community and those people who are most concerned can also be your most powerful advocates. So I would encourage shelters to think more about trying to work with advocates, even if, understandably, advocates can sometimes be a little bit too dramatic. I think it's probably the best way to describe that, or be a little bit unprofessional in their communications. But working with them is always the better outcome, in my experience, if your goal is to help the animals, right? These are people who are coming at it because they care, not because they're bad actors. And I think that's an important thing for governments to remember.
Right. So in conclusion, because we're almost out of time. So in conclusion, if you could recommend one legal change. Now, we're heard globally, but you're based in Georgia, but animal welfare, we're mostly talking about probably the U.S., where most of our listeners are. So in conclusion, if you could make one legal change that would improve animal welfare in the U.S., what would that be?
Unquestionably, it's mandatory spay-neuter.
Oh, that's what I was thinking.
I mean, I don't want to want to recognize that there may be need to be exceptions, like an animal that for medical reasons can't be spayed or neutered, or a legitimate, reputable breeder, right? I'm not trying to get rid of, the wonderful breeds that we have in the United States and elsewhere. But mandatory spay neuter is the absolute best way to address pet overpopulation. And that is the number one problem for animal welfare in the United States. What I always like to tell people is that pet overpopulation, the way we currently address it, is like bailing out a sinking ship over and over and over again. We cannot adopt our way out of this problem. So the best way to do it is to resolve it at the source, which is to plug that leaking boat by making sure that people have to spay neuter their pets, so we don't continue to have this overwhelming pet overpopulation problem.
So, Sherry, thank you so much for coming on Catitude. Where can people find out more information about, you know, the legalities of involving animal welfare?
Sure. So at the University of Georgia Law School, we have what's called the PAWS Clinic, which is the Practicum on Animal Welfare Skills. And that is a great sort of starting base to find some information. And we'll very soon have a series of videos. There's a couple that are already posted that describe a lot of the national challenges that we're dealing with related to animal welfare. That website is https://paws.law.uga.edu. And if you'd like me to say it without that.
So paws.law.uga. UGA.edu.
That's right.
Okay. And I'm pretty sure we can have that link on the page for this episode. Again, thank you so much for coming on Catitude, and thank you for all you do for the animals.
Thank you so much for having me.
I hope everyone enjoyed this episode. So informative. I want to thank Sherry Hines for coming on Catitude and sharing a wealth of knowledge. Thank you so much. Thanks to my cats, All Rescues, Dennis, Charlotte, and Molly. Thanks to my listeners of Catitude. I appreciate your listenership so much. And of course, a huge thank you to my producer, Mark Winter, for working his magic and making every show sound incredible. Now remember, lose the attitude, have catitude.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.